I think this is very much part of the human cycle. Like every 50 years or so, we kind of go through these moments. We saw that in the late 60s. People forget how volatile that was. The president was assassinated. A presidential candidate was assassinated. A leader of the civil rights movement was assassinated. Students were shot on campus at Kent State, all in the space of a few years.
Chad Thevenot, founding leader of the University of Austin, uncovers the dark truth behind today's college educations.
Half the time, the students don't even know that's what they're getting. They think they're getting this kind of broad truth about the world, and what they're really getting is just like a narrow version of what one group believes. If you're interested in reforming universities, you have to ask yourself, what is the incentive of the university to change? And honestly, if you look at the incentives for universities to change, they're not good. You know, it's weird knowing that you're probably living through a moment of history, not just where things are just kind of going along, but like we're seeing this kind of cataclysmic shift.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Chad, thank you for coming over, spending your Friday afternoon with me.
This is perfect. It's right across the street, as you know.
Caddy Corner. There's a lot of synergies going on. I think we need to foster this relationship between the Commons, Unchained, PlebLab now, and UATX. We're very excited to have you as neighbors.
Yes. Look, we're at 6 in Congress right now. The center of the universe. Literally, right? Because you think about it, the United States is the most important country in the world, right? Texas is the most important state in the union. Austin is the heart of Texas. And we are dead center downtown right now in Austin.
It does feel that way. Parker Lewis, I think you may have met him before at Zaprite. I am a refugee from the Northeast, born in Philadelphia, college in Chicago, spent 6 years in New York. Post-COVID, the Bitcoin industry shifted away from New York and San Francisco, and a lot of it settled here on 6th and Congress. And you can feel the energy. Parker is an Austinite and made sure that when I moved down here, I understood the history of Texas, the history of Austin, and the gravity that exists where we sit today.
Exactly. This is a special place right now. And it's not just Bitcoin. It's ideas broadly. And it's more specifically what they would call liberal ideas, not liberal in the current sort of progressive sort of view of that. It's liberal in the sense of freedom, liberty, right? And so the ideas of liberty, we might call them broadly, or what they still call liberalism in higher education, the epicenter of those ideas has shifted over time. You know, hundreds of years ago, it was the Enlightenment in parts of Europe. And then, you know, at different times in the United States, it might have been San Francisco or other parts. Today, it's Austin, Texas, where the ideas of freedom, the ideas of liberty have sort of taken root and are being renewed right here, literally on this corner and in this city.
Yeah. I mean, speaking of your side of the corner at UATX, let's jump into the history of how this came to be, because I didn't even mention this before we hit record, but we were chit-chatting about Trump winning the election and the vibe shift that is certainly happening. And we've been talking about it in the Bitcoin industry, the companies, the individuals that have been working to bring their product to market or develop a Bitcoin stash, the timing is perfect if you're building in the space. I think what you're doing across the street, the timing couldn't be more perfect either, because it seems like you guys have been laying groundwork for a few years now and are really about to take off.
Yes. I mean, there's no question. We've been laying groundwork for a little over 3 years. In fact, it's almost, what's today? November 7th?
7th or 8th, yeah.
Yeah. So tomorrow is the third anniversary since we announced the university on November 8th, 2021. So for 3 years, we talked about this idea of a new university committed to the fearless pursuit of truth, which basically just means freedom of inquiry, the free and open exploration of ideas. That's the kind of thing a university ought to do, but they weren't doing. So we sort of doubled down on that principle. And so we've been building it. Nobody thought you could build a university in 3 years. We've done it. We promised from the beginning we would have students start in the fall of 2024. They started in September 2024. We have our first class. So yes, there's so much energy in Austin. It's the kind of place where you can get things done. And culturally, we're seeing a shift. And we've seen it slowly over the last 3 years, but we're seeing that sort of accelerate. So separate from the politics of the moment, beyond the politics, there's been a slow sort of simmering shift in the culture. And the culture is wanting, I think, to return to some common sense, return to evidence and reason, rather than just your kind of hysteria. And a lot of that orbits around the university, the kind of things that we're doing. Early on, we were saying, look, let's just get back to the core principles, right? Just merit, you know, freedom of inquiry, what we call intellectual pluralism, which is basically just a diversity of ideas in the classroom. Because if you're going to explore ideas, it can't just, if you've already figured it out, then you're not exploring. Then it's just an orthodoxy. It's a kind of church if you already know what the right idea is. But if you don't know what the right idea is, you're honestly exploring ideas, you need a diversity of thought. So anyways, those are the kinds of things that I see out in the world. I'm not interested in politics at all. I've never been interested in politics, so I don't follow it nearly as closely as most people. But I follow I follow culture, basically, which is upstream of politics. And that's very much what I see with the university as being part of a cultural sort of shift. That's what I see with Bitcoin, without a doubt. People are rethinking, you know, what it means, what currency means, and Bitcoin as an asset and so on. And it's happening in like almost every space, in my view, in the country, whether that's education or finance or higher education or whatever. There's this sort of shift that we can do things better.
Yeah. And I was telling you that understanding, I studied economics at DePaul University in Chicago, and there's like a two-pronged way to better understand Bitcoin. One, studying economics at university, at a typical university in the United States in the 21st century means you're inundated with Keynesian neoliberal doctrine.
Right.
And it's taught as gospel. This is the way the economy works. And luckily for me, I was able to find Bitcoin, which pushed me into the exploration of Austrian economics and an alternative view of how the economy does and probably should work. And it highlighted me as like, why am I not learning about any of these concepts in my economics major? And that was like highlight number one. Number two, funnily enough, had to write a paper about student loan debt and really discovered how the introduction of easy money into the university system specifically created these perverse incentives where the universities know that the government and the culture more broadly are pushing people to go get your degrees and get a good job. The government is giving out loans to anybody who needs to get them. And so they're able to increase their cost and implant an administrative layer that just feeds off the money spigot that student loan debt creates. And then it leads to this situation where you're not actually forced to create an environment where people are exploring ideas and actually learning earnestly. It's almost like a factory good at that
point. Yeah, exactly. Look, I mean, the ballooning cost of higher education is one of the problems that we're tackling. So we have three core principles we were founded on. One is the fearless pursuit of truth. It's this idea of sort of freedom of inquiry and intellectual pluralism. The second is a new kind of curriculum, which we can talk about, but basically a curriculum for the 21st century. And the third is the financial model. So for example, our tuition is half of what other elite institutions are charging. And the core reason it's half is because we don't have any of the kind of legacy nonsense that a lot of other universities have. So for example, we don't have the bloated administration, which is the number one cause of this increase in cost, or at least the number one sort of symptom. The cause is exactly what you're saying. It's just these incentives, right? If we create an incentive, if a third party comes in and says, well, I'm going to give you money to turn around and give the universities are like, great. You know, we'll take more money. And so the student takes money from the government in the form of loans, and then I give it to the university, and then the university just ratchets up the cost. So I go back and I say, I need more loans. And then all of a sudden, surprise, surprise, right? The incentives are there for an increased cost that are going to be basically subsidized by the government. And then you, the student, get stuck in between with this debt. So one of the things we're doing this semester, or rather this year, is we have full academic tuition for all of our students. That means all of the students at least graduate without having debt from their tuition. They still have to pay their housing and their food, but that's pretty affordable. Mm-hmm. But and so that's one of the ways, like at least this year and this coming year, we've already committed to basically free tuition for the students.
So Freaks, this episode of TFTC is brought to you by our good friends at Unchained. Do you have an old IRA or 401k that isn't keeping up with Bitcoin? Roll over into an Unchained Bitcoin IRA and take advantage of Bitcoin's long-term potential while enjoying tax-deferred growth. With Unchained, you hold real Bitcoin and keep control of your keys, reducing counterparty risk through their collaborative custody model, while Unchained handles the tax forms. It's very important. They handle the tax forms. Get started now with no setup fees and no account fee for the first year. Not only is this the only standard Bitcoin IRA where you can control keys, unlike other Bitcoin IRAs, you can take distributions directly in Bitcoin, avoiding exchange fees. Set up a Roth or traditional Bitcoin IRA for no charge today at unchained.com/TFTC and experience true ownership of your retirement savings. Go to unchained.com/TFTC. This rip is also brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. CoinKite builds the best Bitcoin hardware in the world. There is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. If you're looking to secure and self-custody your Bitcoin, you can get the MK4 or the ColdCard Q. ColdCard Q has a full keyboard, a QR scanner, NFC enabled, has a battery pack, put some AA batteries in there, create private public keys off pair in an air gap fashion. Private keys never have to touch an online device. They have their Sats card, which is the best way to give Bitcoin. If you're looking to gift Bitcoin for a wedding, a birthday party, a communion, a bar mitzvah, whatever it may be, tap the card on the back of your phone. You get an address to send to. You send it to that address. It lives on the Sats card. Again, there is no second best when it comes to Bitcoin hardware. The Bitcoin price seems to be going up. You want to take care of your security before Bitcoin goes to six figures. Make sure you get your Bitcoin off exchanges using CoinKite hardware. MK4, ColdCard Q. Go to CoinKite.com. Use the code TFTC. We have a code now, TFTC, for 5% off at checkout. Talking about the debt, too, it compounds. Not only, you know, it compounds into it. You have the financial debt, which obviously compounds over time as you get your degree and you go to the workforce and find that the jobs that you were promised are not either there or as lucrative as you thought they would be. And then, too, the intellectual debt compounds as well, because that factory mindset of education and indoctrination, which is frankly what many of the universities have turned into, these indoctrination camps, like, really leaves individuals at a disservice in the long run, because unless you have the cognizant ability to recognize that you're being indoctrinated and actively work to rewire your brain and seek out ideas outside of the walls of the university, you're probably running down a path of intellectual dishonesty for longer than you otherwise should. And so you have this financial debt compounding with this intellectual debt that builds up over time. And individually, like, it's a problem, but if you add those individuals into a group, into a whole nation, a generation of people, it's pretty systemically adverse to the success of the nation.
Yeah, look, there's no question. If you're not prepared for reality, if you're just prepared for some fantasy version of the world, that puts you at an extreme, you know, odd disposition. You're going out into the world and you've only heard one point of view, right? And one version of the world, the way the world ought to be under some particular vision, as opposed to the way the world is. So it's always struck me as odd. So, like, let's say I go to college and I'm protected from sort of all of these ideas, right? That might hurt my feelings or might challenge my beliefs or my presumptions. Well, as soon as I leave college, I'm in the grocery store aisle and I'm seeing magazines and I'm talking to people and I'm going to restaurants and I'm working jobs and I'm having conversations. None of that stuff is going to be catered to me. I'm not going to be sheltered. I'm not going to be protected. Like, that's the real world. I'm going to see ideas, see people, experience things that are completely at odds with this narrow version that had been given in higher ed. You can immediately see how ill-prepared I'm going to be. And this is why I think a lot of people shut down. They're not prepared for the fact that other people have different kinds of experiences, different kinds of ideas. The world doesn't exactly work exactly the way that people want to. So the one thing we ought to be teaching people is the one thing we're not, is the opposite of what we're doing. We ought to be teaching people how to be anti-fragile, how to be resilient, how to be agile in terms of being able to shift with different ideas, different trends, different changes in a highly dynamic world. And instead, we're teaching them to basically be orthodox, sort of, you know, it's almost like this kind of secular orthodox view of the world, and that's it. Yeah.
Like teaching people how you should know things, not how to think and develop the ability to come to your own conclusions.
Yeah, and you're right. Look, half the time the students don't even know that's what they're getting. They think they're getting some version of the truth, you know, and what they're really getting is just what they think they're getting, this kind of broad truth about the world, and what they're really getting is just like a narrow version of what one group believes.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the infection of the woke mind virus into the university system has been a topic of recent years, particularly post BLM. But I mean, I graduated college in 2013, and I vividly remember having to take, it wasn't an elective, it was a mandatory class on multiculturalism, which basically taught that people with my complexion, eye color, and hair color were the reason that everything is bad in the world. And literally, to pass the class, I had to acknowledge that doctrine. And
yeah, where was this?
DePaul University in Chicago. And even back then, this was before it became apparent socially that this was a thing. Like, wokeness probably didn't accelerate until 2017 forward through COVID.
Yeah.
In the sense that it was front and center in everyday life, but the seeds of that indoctrination were at least around when I was in college. And I was essentially like, what the fuck? Like, getting in debates in class, like trying to defend, like, I'm a good person, like I'm an individual. And
right,
it's
look, when people are, you know, when people are called racist or misogynistic and stuff all the time, and they believe in their own heart that they're not, then you know they're going to be at odds with that. The sad thing is look, it, as a nation, we spent decades trying to have a sort of a reckoning, you know, around civil rights and around women's rights and so on, and that was a good thing. Right. And I saw a lot of that. I'm quite a bit older than you. So I saw it throughout the 70s and the 80s. And we made some progress. And we also learned to better understand each other and live with each other. Right. And so we would experience each other's cultures and ideas and challenges. And so what I saw personally was a lot of progress, even as a Southerner from Louisiana. You know, I saw from some bad behavior to increasingly better behavior. All the way up through college in the 1990s. So in my view, we were making progress. It wasn't perfect, but we were being exposed to other people and other ideas. But it was part of an organic kind of evolutionary process, a social evolution process. It wasn't this idea that we're going to force you to take a course, and then in the process of that course, we're going to demonize you. That's going to give you the opposite, right? People are going to, they're going to reject that and just sort of say, well, hold on. You know, this whole thing's not about me, and it's not about, like, and you don't even know me. Every person's experience is different, of course. And so in a sense, it's anti-progress, because it's this perversion of this idea of we're going to get to know each other better, or we're going to be more tolerant by being less tolerant. It's like, well, wait, hold on. The whole idea was that we were going to integrate society, right? Whether that's race, class, gender, sexual identity, whatever, and have more of this melting pot. But as soon as you start making it sort of like, you know, the Ministry of Culture, mm-hmm. that's going to come down and have exact dictates, and it's going to cancel you if you don't go along with the agenda, then you get this massive backlash, which is what we're seeing today.
Yeah.
And so it's good. The backlash is good in the sense that it's a backlash to some of the excesses of that. It's bad in the sense that we still do have this fundamental challenge of living in a pluralistic society, right? And so it breaks my heart a little bit that some of the progress we've been made that had been made, I think, for decades, certainly from the 60s through maybe the 2000s, we're now sort of, we've lost some of that ground.
Certainly lost some of that ground, but the silver lining is it highlights that humanity as a collective does still have this inherent immune system that sort of rejects at some point. Like, obviously things have gotten bad, but it has gotten to a point where people are throwing their hands up saying, this is insane. We need something new.
Exactly. I think, it did reach a point of insanity. And so then everyday people, I mean, a lot of people believed that it was insane, but they felt like they couldn't say it because mm-hmm. they didn't want to lose their friends or they didn't want to get canceled or whatever. And now people, I think, feel very comfortable just sort of saying, hey, look, this is crazy. Mm-hmm. You know, the fact that I can't talk about the fact that I'm a holder of Bitcoin because that's somehow going to make me some conspiratorial Republican or something. I mean, that's crazy, right? Like, so I'm hoping we can get back to like the Thanksgiving dinner. We have Thanksgiving coming up where you're sitting across from your family and friends and you have differences and you make fun of each other a little bit and, you know, you poke and you prod and then everybody gets along, right?
Yeah.
You don't have to agree. You know, it's not that, it's not about making each other agree with each other. It's just understanding, right? It's just like, oh, my uncle believes this because he has had this kind of experience. I don't get it, but he does, and I love him, and that's fine.
Yeah. You know? I mean, coming from the Northeast, there's a lot of that in my family specifically, but I love my family at the end of the day. I prefer to talk about time spent at the beach and the jokes and the practical jokes that we played on each other growing up. But I hope moving forward we can get away from the political divisiveness and the focus of, if you're meeting with family and friends particularly, you're forced to talk about these political topics, which is not where society should be at all.
Yeah.
We should be talking about ideas that are outside the political landscape, which gets to like developing a curriculum, creating a new university, and basically trying to form a curriculum in an environment where you're actually battle testing these ideas. What does that process look like? How did it look like for you guys?
Well, for us, we had a vision right out the gate on the kind of curriculum that we thought would be valuable for students. And so we have a two-sided coin, basically. On one side of that coin is what they would call the liberal arts or the classical liberal arts. And all the liberal arts is it's how do you learn to live in a free and open society, right? It's this Jeffersonian ideal of if we're going to be self-governing, we have to learn how to be self-governing. So it's philosophy and history and law and economics where we learn about the world, particularly about the world in a liberal society, a society that has a relative freedom and openness. That's all it meant. So it's living in how to live in that kind of world. So we believe in that, right? So going all the way back to classics, you know, going all the way back to Socrates and the Bible or whatnot, all the way forward to modern thinkers, how does that tell us about about ourselves as people, as humans? What does it tell us about human institutions like banking or higher ed or the criminal justice system? And what does it tell us about societies, right? What are these perennial questions in these disciplines that inform us about the human experience? It's that simple. So we think that's necessary. If you don't have that grounding and that depth and breadth about the human experience, then you become like a technician, mm-hmm. like an automaton,
a cog in the machine,
right? And so you have to have that grounding in the humanities. Literally, call it the humanities and social sciences. That grounding kind of pulls you into being a human, and it, in the process, it increases your empathy for other humans. You can see that other humans, either before us or even now, are wrestling with the same kinds of questions, right? So that's half the curriculum. The other half is oriented towards moving forward, how do we take all this experience and all this learning about humanity and use it to make the world even better moving forward, right? So how do we solve problems? How do we develop new policies, new technologies, new nonprofits, new art and music that makes the world better, more beautiful, more just? And so that's what we call that the Polaris Project. So Polaris is the North Star. So it's half sort of liberal arts and half entrepreneurship and innovation, like moving forward. And they're not like two separate things where it's bifurcated. They're two sides of the same coin. It's very hard to be an ethical and principled entrepreneur or leader if you're not grounded in a firm understanding of what's come before.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I was actually the minor, or I didn't minor in it, but all my electives were taken in philosophy, reading like Plato, Socrates, Nietzsche even. And that's one thing that's been completely lost. And that's, I mean, we don't have to go too hard into the woke mind virus, but the idea of, it's a pretty popular idea these days, is the fact that like you had Marxist individuals sort of infiltrate the university system more broadly here in the United States, and via concerted effort try to basically wash over that history and that important knowledge that came before us.
Yeah.
And that's again, going back to what I said earlier, it's the intellectual debt that accrues from that is pretty significant. I think the works of literature and art that have been produced throughout the years, particularly in philosophy, and philosophers throughout time have said very similar things in different ways, like these first principle beliefs about how the world works and how logic works are pretty consistent throughout time for a reason. And it's being able to have that base knowledge of logic, first principles, that allows you to continue progress. And it feels like a lot of that ancient knowledge has been actively glossed over in the university system. A lot of universities, obviously, there's some that are better than others.
Exactly. Some are better than others, for sure. And some departments are better than others, even within the same university. So it's hard. You can't paint it with a broad brush, for sure. But I think you can say, look, the general trend line has been to move away from some of these, the liberal arts, right? Some of this classical thinking and so on, to just sort of practical, you know, knowledge, because we're preparing people for their career. Well, I think that's true in part. You're preparing people for some discipline, to be an engineer or to be a doctor or to be a teacher. But you're not just preparing people to be technicians within a field. We ought to be preparing people to be better humans, right? So that for them, for their own purposes, their own transformation, but also their contributions to a free and open society, right? Are they better neighbors? Are they better citizens of a free society? Are they better bosses? That requires something much different than just figuring out how to, you know, put a widget in place. Mm-hmm. And that's where philosophy and history and stuff come in. It teaches us about all this rich understanding that people before us have come, you know, have developed. It's like, why wouldn't we want that, right? We're dropped into this world kind of, you know, out of nowhere, and we're figuring our way out in the world and wanting to make good decisions. And there's all this history before us. Is there really nothing to learn from that history? We're not better off as an individual if we don't, you know, it makes no sense. Of course we want to, you know, it's to our personal advantage to sit there and go, what have people learned before me so I don't have to learn it myself, right? And so to kind of discount all of that and just sort of say, no, it's just about how you tighten up the screw tighter, makes no sense.
Yeah.
In fact, that kind of knowledge, that technical knowledge, is easier than it's ever been, because we live in an information economy, right? We can go get that knowledge. If I want to learn how to fix my dishwasher, I can now like watch a YouTube video for 5 minutes and I can solve a problem that might have taken me an engineering degree to get before, right? So that's not the problem. The problem is figuring out how do we live, you know, productive, healthy lives in a free society with other people who are trying to do the same thing, who have differences, and we have conflicting interests and so on. The biggest challenge we face is literally just the day-to-day communications and personal interactions and our own emotions and our own, you know, stresses. It's not, you know, we've got plenty of access to technical knowledge. So it's just reshifting the emphasis back to sort of say, look, we don't want to lose everything that's come before.
And with this in mind, how are you guys gauging success of the new university that you've created?
Well, it's important to remember we just had our first trimester starting in, you know, 2 months ago. So to this point, you know, success has been hitting these milestones of launching university. Most importantly, you know, having our first class of students start in September, which we did. And that alone, honestly, is a bit of a miracle. To launch a university is an insane, insane thing. The regulatory burdens are almost prohibitive. The financial burden in terms of the resources necessary are just extraordinary. So for all of these reasons, like, it's very, very difficult. So hitting these milestones, particularly starting with students this fall, is success. Now, of course, we're very much focused on how do we get better? How do we grow? Some of that is, of course, continuing to recruit students, being able to lower the acceptance rate, meaning we're basically getting the best students. We certainly have an excellent class this year, but But I think we're going to have an even stronger classes moving forward as we gain a reputation for being, you know, a strong institution. It's fundraising, of course, because we have to have the resources to do this. At this point, in, you know, in our infancy, we're 100% philanthropy. You know, we don't have a revenue model yet. We will in the next 5 years or so, but we don't today. So we have to raise money. And that money, of course, is a signal of whether we're doing a good job, or whether people think we're doing a good job, and so on. Accreditation is a hoop we have to jump through, and that would represent a certain level of success in terms of, you know, being able to meet the standards that are set before us from regulators. And we're really well positioned for all of that. I mean, this institution, even though it's only 3 years old, is incredibly strong. I mean, we have put on so much muscle in 3 years. It's just incredible.
Yeah. And diving into the regulatory landscape, as we were talking about it before with Trump coming to office and many people surmising that if he's going to implement this high tariffs, low income tax regime, he's going to need to cut spending. And he has spoken publicly, or people around the campaign have spoken publicly about cutting departments like the Department of Education. And have the Department of Education been a hindrance to what you're trying to do?
No, but I think it's a hindrance in part to innovation within higher education, and as well as K-12, like education broadly. Mm-hmm. So I think there are real problems there, and I think it's getting in the way of bringing about the kind of choice and innovation that people really want. It's a one-size-fits-all approach when you have the federal government sort of dictating terms. Do we need to abolish the Department of Education? I have no idea. Do we need some serious reform, maybe all the way up to abolish? Sure. You know, I think there needs to be a really radical look at what we're doing. So, you know, we're in favor in having an environment that just allows more upstarts, right? Makes it a little easier for new universities to be started, new schools to be started, new kinds of curriculum, new kinds of technologies around education. All of that's a good thing, right? Competition is a good thing. It raises everyone up to a higher standard. So I'd like to see that. I certainly don't want to see more regulation, right? We don't want more requirements that, and most, some of which are just either political. So they're just not, it's not good. You know, these kind of political litmus tests that you were talking about with your class, or they're just unnecessary bureaucracy that just stifle the process of innovation. And that's true of almost any department, but certainly the Department of Education has its own problems.
Yeah. This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends at Zaprite. If you're a Bitcoiner and run a business or an independent contractor, you should be accepting Bitcoin as payment. If not you, then who? If we believe that fiat is systemically fragile and is a risk, the rails that currency runs on are a risk as well. You need to begin accepting Bitcoin as soon as possible. Invest in the future of your business. Create a redundant rail by accepting Bitcoin as payment using Zaprite and reduce risk for your business. I've done this for my business. Here at TFTC, we use Zaprite. It allows you to easily create invoices, payment links, or connect e-commerce stores, connect your wallets or custodial accounts, and be set up in minutes. We can also connect our bank accounts, our Stripe accounts, or Square accounts to accept fiat as well. The time is now, freaks. The fiat system is fragile. Invest in the infrastructure that de-risks the future. Invest in yourself. Bitcoin payments with Zaprite. Go to Zaprite.com/TFTC to get $40 off their annual subscription. Zaprite.com/TFTC, $40 off. This RIP was also brought to you by our good friends at Salt of the Earth. You got to be hydrating, freaks. And while you're hydrating, you got to be getting your electrolytes. This is the best electrolytes mix that I've ever come into contact with. Pink Himalayan salt with calcium, magnesium, potassium, sodium, no sugar. It tastes incredible. My favorite is the orange and the pink lemonade. Go to drinksote.com. That's drinksote.com. Use the code TFTC when you make your purchase and you'll get 15% off. I'm telling you, get on it, freaks. You're going to love this stuff. Move around a little bit here, just as you're discussing this, like you've thought about this a lot, like how, like what's your background before UATX, and like what was the impetus that drove you to say, all right, we're going to do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because you don't, yeah, my experience has been it's very, very hard to sort of plan out your career, right, and then end up where you are. Like, you know, there's no way when I was, you know, 30 years ago when I was starting my career that I thought I'd be where I am today. You know, it's just radically different. I went to business school at the University of Texas. I went to Georgetown University for graduate school in cultural studies. So I actually studied a lot of this critical theory and so on. Not so much as a sympathizer. I was actually just interested in ideas. And I'm particularly interested in society and in culture. I mentioned this earlier, culture is upstream from politics, in my view. And that's really important because we're having these fights around politics, but in some ways we're having them 10 years or 20 years too late at that point. By the time you have the fight in politics, it's already done. The cake's baked. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to go upstream of politics, you have to think about culture. And what are the cultural institutions? Well, it's entertainment. It's higher education. Right now it's things like blogs and so on. That's upstream. And so that's what I spent my career doing, is thinking about culture, thinking about what they call social change. And in particular, sort of how do societies change, how do cultures change, and how do they change for the best? Because there's, of course, there's bad social change, right? When all of a sudden you have, you know, Nazis or communists or something. And then there's good social change where people are, there's more peace, there's more prosperity and so on. Well, where does that come from? Where does positive social change come from? So in looking at those questions, I got obsessed with the idea of liberalism, again, properly understood. The way to understand liberalism as in this proper sense is to look at the Enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. And the values that came out of the Enlightenment, which are things like pluralism, the rule of law, democracy, the scientific method, very basic things that we almost take for granted now.
Private property, right?
Private property, absolutely. Free enterprise, constitutional protections. These are all things that came out of the Enlightenment. These are all of what we would call liberal values. And higher education in the United States is supposed to be a liberal institution about living in a society that has those values, right? If you look at institutions and you look at societies that have embraced these classical, we'll call them classical liberal values so people aren't confused, it is absolutely clear that those societies across time and across geography have done better. Classical societies that adhere to liberal values, they're not just doing a little bit better. They're doing 10x, 100x better. And now, of course, there's all these memes around this where you can see satellite footage of North Korea versus South Korea. That tells you everything. This is also true. I traveled to Cyprus about 20 years ago. Cyprus is divided in half. And there is a more liberal, again, classical liberal, Enlightenment-informed sort of south, less so in the north, including the capital city, which is divided in half. You can climb up these ladders, you can look over the wall, I forget the name of the capital city, and you're standing in the same city, in the same country, with the same people, in the same geography, and it's radically different. And it's clearly better in the south than it is in the north. That is not, so you can't say, oh, it's resources or it's people, or it has to do with what values were realized out in that society.
It's funny, I saw a picture on X the other week of the border of, I believe it was Monaco in France, and the, is that right? Is that sound right?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, and it was like stark difference, like Monaco, like way better than France. Likewise, I mean, you see it here in the United States, driving through the Northeast Corridor. I had a wedding in New Hampshire once, and you drive through Massachusetts to get to New Hampshire, and as soon as you cross the border into the Free State, the roads are materially better.
Like, yeah.
You're driving on 95 in Massachusetts.
Yes.
And literally, once you cross the border, the road is well-maintained and much better. It's insane to see.
Exactly. And that's not people or geography. That's policy. And that policy, again, is informed by the kind of culture that, the kinds of things that we support, the kinds of things that we value, right? Texas is great at this. Texas is not perfect, just like the U.S. is not perfect. But as a state, Texas, I think, has the right values and is doing a good job of seeing a lot of that through in the terms of the kinds of policies it has. But the culture is what really matters, right? And one amazing thing about Austin is how diverse and heterodox it is. It's a place where people come to do new things, whether that's art or technology or education or politics. Where there's this kind of creative conflict, the good kind of conflict that you want, where, you know, it's these ideas are converging and they're sort of conflicting, and then new stuff is born out of it. And so it's an unbelievably creative environment. You know, people kind of characterize Austin in the, you know, it's the blue city and the red state, kind of. But, you know, if you walk around Austin, you see all kinds of different people. You can go to a restaurant and you're going to be sitting next to the person who's this crazy sort of progressive with blue hair, right next to the really uptight Republican guy, and they're getting along or they're having lunch together. And you're like, well, what's going on here? Well, that it's because it's that's the sort of creative energy that that's allowed to actually interact culturally and learn from each other, right, and kind of bounce ideas off each other that you don't see when everybody in other parts of in other states kind of go off to their corner. And so it's one of the really it's and that's true in my view, that's true about every aspect of Austin, that there's these differences, but the differences are allowed to kind of come together. And you don't see that in other states. You see people sort of separating, moving into different neighborhoods and different friend groups and so on.
Yeah, I mean, as somebody who's lived in three of the bluest cities in the country, in Philadelphia, Chicago, New York.
Yeah.
When everybody scoffs at me because I live in Austin and in Texas, they're like, oh, it's the Libs capital. I'm like, yeah, compared to the other cities I lived in, this is vastly superior. And
yes, without a doubt. Look, I lived in D.C. for many years, and that was a city that was more uniform in its views, and you had to kind of watch what you would say. I don't ever feel that way in Austin. I feel like I could talk to my conservative friends or my progressive friends and be honest, and I'm not going to get, you know, I'm not going to get shot down or canceled from it. I mean, we might have a passionate discussion, and that's fine. I mean, that's how we challenge each other, right? That's growth.
Yeah.
But you know, in the DC area, it got to a point where you couldn't even have a real conversation. It was really a bummer.
Similarly in New York, Chicago really wasn't having those conversations as much at a younger age, but as I get older, particularly after you have kids, those conversations rear their heads.
Yeah,
I think it's much easier to have them down here.
So that's the microcosm for, you know, those kind of conversations are the microcosm for the macro situation in higher ed, right? In a sense, the research, the teaching, the mentoring can't really happen because it's stifled. Mm-hmm. People self-censor, people cancel each other. And so the very thing that higher ed exists to do, which is to sort of foster conversation, foster exploration, is the very thing that it's failing to do. And that's what was so frustrating and so depressing. And that's what fed energy into us starting the University of Austin. People would, you know, we get characterized, you know, the Wall Street Journal recently had an article about us where they use anti-woke in the title. And I'm like, no, you're not understanding. This isn't about woke or anti-woke. This is literally about whether the core purpose of higher education, this is about exploring ideas or having an orthodox view of ideas.
And how has the faculty, what is their vibe like? Because I was mentioning as we were taking the elevator ride up, John Constable.
Yeah.
Brought him over from the UK.
Exactly.
He's pretty prolific in the world of energy and physics. And I'm supposed to meet up with him at some point here in the next couple of weeks, and just really interested to get his perspective on why UATX and like, what are you feeling? Is there a sense of, wow, I feel like I'm actually able to go and have the relationship with students that I've been looking for?
Yeah. I mean, look, the faculty in some ways are exactly what you'd hope. They're all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. Different disciplines, different sort of political sentiments, different personalities. I mean, look, the first thing we hired for with faculty was their merit, their abilities, right? And particularly, right, at this stage, their ability to teach, because that's what we're starting with. We're a full-blown university teaching and research, but we're starting with these students come in as undergrad, and so we need great teachers. So they're great teachers. So they have that in common. We also look for faculty who ideally demonstrate some level of courage, right? Because it's the fearless pursuit of truth. Pursuing truth in this environment, like openly exploring ideas, I mean, really doing it requires some courage, particularly in this environment where, you know, if you say things, you get shut down and so on. So we needed to know that they had the courage to kind of to live out this principle of the fearless pursuit of truth. So they have that. So they have some of those stories about, you know, how they felt in the classroom. And people think it's just conservatives. It's not. I mean, your mainstream sort of left of center professor was feeling shut down from people even further left than they are.
Yeah, we saw this in Australia with the oceanographer who at one point said, climate change is killing the Great Barrier Reef. And then he went back and did research a decade later, and reefs becoming revived. And he came and just brought, like, hey, I think I was wrong.
Yeah.
The Great Barrier Reef is recovering, and he got fired.
Right. Exactly. And so every one of those instances of that happening is a chilling effect for scientists, for researchers, for teachers. And that's why it's so important. Look, even if it's not completely prolific in one area, if people know about it, right? It's kind of like going down the highway and you know that you've heard that there's like one or two cops on the next stretch of 50 miles. That's all you need to know, right? Just the possibility that you're going to get that ticket is enough to sort of quash what you're doing. So it doesn't even have to exist everywhere. It just has to exist enough to make you afraid. And so then that's why the professors start to self-censor. That's why the students start to self-censor. So that's why there has to be this really kind of radical commitment to the fearless pursuit of truth. Because you can't even have one instance where you're shutting somebody down for political reasons. Because it has this ripple effect.
And that manifests at UATX, like outside the classroom as well, because I know you guys are working on curating talks and discussions.
Yeah.
Forums as well, correct?
Yeah, and we've already done a lot of that, and we still do a lot of that. So there's a lot of public sort of facing stuff, both events and speakers and whatnot, but also content that we put online. I mean, we're fairly prolific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And has the work that you've done going out with the ambitious goal of starting university, getting through the red tape, getting it across the line, has it inspired others? Is that your hope?
Yeah, it was always our hope to do two things. One was to start a new university and, you know, committed to the fearless pursuit of truth and have students start by the fall of 24, and we did that. The parallel goal was by doing that it would inspire other institutions and, you know, and people around those institutions to, you know, to think about things differently and think about what the possibilities are, basically to inspire them towards a better way forward, to be a light in the darkness. Right. And we, you know, we see this so much, but some of it's also very private. When we have university presidents reaching out to us consistently and saying, look, this is great. I can't say it publicly, but it's great. Keep going. You know, it's helping the kinds of conversations I'm having with our faculty or with our board or whatever. We get that from boards of trustees. We get it from major donors of other institutions. They're all, 100% calling us up and saying, this is great. We encourage it. This is helping change the conversation in higher ed. Some of them don't feel like they can be public about that, but they definitely want us to succeed. And they've asked us about starting new institutions. We've been offered institutions in other cities that are on their way out. And they've asked us, you know, can we save their institution?
That's what I was going to bring. Justin Moon out there, he was screaming at me as we were running into the studio. We've had this conversation a lot. There's a part of the public, or maybe not the public, but there's a group of people who want to tear down institutions like the Ivy Leagues, and they think it's gotten way overblown, way too indoctrinated. And we've had this back and forth. So like, do you tear it down or do you try and like reinvigorate the institution? Are these institutions worth saving, I guess, is another way to frame it. And do they need something like a UATX as an external signal of competition? Like,
yes,
we are forced to reinvigorate and preserve this institution in the long run.
Yes. Look, higher education is absolutely worth saving, but it's also must be renewed, right? In a sense, it's a renewal. It's a coming back to its original purpose and with a new sort of relevance, a new commitment, a new vibrancy. So it's not about throwing it out and burning it down. But it is about taking a sober look at what is its core purpose, recommitting to that, and then making that real through your policies, your practice, the kind of culture you're building, the people you hire, all of that. So there needs to be a very robust sort of renewal, and an institution like UATX can, and I think should be part of that, you know, providing some guidance, providing some lessons learned, providing some inspiration. That's very much part of what we want to do. We'd love to see dozens, if not hundreds, of other institutions out there competing with us, in a sense, to try to do things better. I think that's how you get there. I think you need competition. I think you need some outside forces. I don't think the answer is this sort of marginal reforms that they've been trying with universities. Like, let's have this little project off to the side. You know, these projects off to the side that they kind of bolt on to universities don't succeed. because they're overwhelmed by the incentives within the university, right? They're completely overwhelmed by it. I mean, if you're interested in reforming universities, you have to ask yourself a single question to start, which is, what is the incentive of the university to change? And honestly, if you look at the incentives for universities to change, they're not good. There's not a lot of incentive for change. Right. So you have a big problem. If you're somebody who wants to sort of see higher ed be reformed, you have to answer that question about what are the incentives. And if you don't have a good answer to that question, you know you got a problem. And that's very much, again, I think where we were 3 years ago. That doesn't mean burn it down. That just means like we need a more radical sort of fix. We need a more fundamental kind of answer.
Yeah, the thing I can think of is taking away the student loans, where it's like, hey, you don't get this free money spigot anymore. You've got to actually compete.
Exactly. I mean, at least those kinds of things should be looked at, because you know, when it comes to sort of a more radical shift, and you want things like accountability, you want transparency. I mean, things like accountability and transparency put the light of day on institutions, whatever they are, businesses, higher ed. And that's the kind of thing that gives people a view into what's happening and saying, whoa, 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 you're doing what? Oh, I'm not going to give you my money, or I'm not going to have my kids go to the school, or, you know, whatever. So in some ways, there needs to be much stronger governance. There's the governance within higher education, the kind of oversight that we've had, it's been appalling. And the thing is, these are really good people. So I'm not trying to knock these people individually. A lot of the people that are in these kind of governing board type of roles are very successful business people, very smart and so on. But they've let the administrators and so on just run amok. The first thing I would like to see is the boards of trustees and the major donors and sort of the people that are basically have governing oversight of these institutions start to hold people accountable to their own values, to their own what they're saying that they stand for. If they stand for merit, then they stand for merit. What does that look like? If they stand for institutional neutrality, what does that look like? Let's make it real. Let's don't just talk about it. We've got to move past this kind of, I don't know, laissez-faire almost sort of governance of higher ed and keep pretending like it's going to be okay, to like a much more Elon Musk-esque kind of aggressive go in and clean things out a bit and hold some people accountable. And it's like, if you're not going to do the job of maintaining this institution's values, its core values, then you can't be the president.
Yeah, this is our ultimate goal. Are you working to achieve that? Here's some KPIs and benchmarks we want to see you hit. If you don't hit them.
Exactly. And I mean, that's true for any institution. So that's not some radical departure. That's true for businesses or whatever. We don't see that much in higher ed. You saw a little bit of accountability last winter, you know, when Claudine Gay, you know, showed this kind of cowardice during her her testimony before Congress. And so she got held accountable. And so did the woman from Columbia, or was it Penn? I can't remember now. And that sent a signal again. That sent a good signal to other institutions that, like, oh, we got to start paying attention. So that was helpful. But again, there are like something like 4,000 institutions of higher ed. And some of these institutions have these enormous endowments and these huge base of alumni and the huge base of local, state, and federal support. All of those things create incentives for the status quo, not for change.
I mean, speaking of endowments, that is a good segue.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, that's mentioning I work at a fund, 1031. We interact with a lot of endowments to raise money and to help steward their capital. And that, having done that for the last 3 years now, getting to understand the ultimate goals of these endowments and how they can achieve their ability to fund what they want to go do, whether that's subsidize schooling for individuals, build new facilities, whatever. You've got to get creative of how you actually establish and then grow and maintain that endowment into the future. And I'm very happy to see that UATX launch and you guys have an endowment with Bitcoin at the core of it. And
yep,
so what were the thought, what was the thought process and decision process that went into making that ultimate decision?
Well, so some level of endowment is good, right? You need, and I think want to, as a university, to create endowed funds for things like scholarships, right? So you have that money in perpetuity to be able to offer scholarships to students in need, or for merit. You want things like endowed chairs. If you want to be able to attract top-notch intellectuals and scholars, it's very helpful if there's money in the bank where you're drawing 5% roughly a year to pay for that chair. And so that individual in the university knows there's stability, right? So that's a good version of the endowment. So the idea was just that, like any kind of investment strategy, we want to diversify our risk. We want to diversify our portfolio. Why aren't people doing that with Bitcoin, right, as a long-term asset? If you look at how Bitcoin was performed over the last 5 years, you could at least have a plausible hope that it's going to perform well moving forward. Maybe it doesn't, but you'd have some reason to believe that it will. So you put it in your portfolio, and so that's what we're doing. We view it as a long-term asset that we think is going to do well. We want that in the portfolio. So that's the practical part. The more ideological part, if you will, or philosophical part, is that we believe what it stands for. In our mind, it stands for free speech, free expression. Well, that's what we're all about. That's our DNA. So, we're this close to Bitcoin, right, in the Bitcoin community. We get it, right? We get what it means to kind of want a way out of the madness of an institution and towards some freedom and control. And so, there's that kind of community connection, and we're seeing this. Like, so many of our supporters, our students, they're all interested in Bitcoin.
Yeah. Well, it was this your personal journey to Bitcoin. Were you did you understand Bitcoin before you made the decision,
no,
or was it something you came to understand as?
I mean, I have some Bitcoin. I've had it for a number of years, but I was more like, it was a whim, whatever, a few years ago, and that was the end of it. I never got into it personally in terms of really understanding it until more recently. I blame Joe Kelly for this. he was telling me more about it, and I was listening, and Jonathan was talking with me as well. And then I was like, wow, this really is important. I need to pay more attention. I'm a really curious person. So everything interests me, which is kind of a problem in the sense that I can deep dive into, literature or music or whatever, and just go deep for a year or two. So I hadn't been paying attention really, honestly, to Bitcoin, at least not that much. But I have a lot of friends, and the university, of course, has a lot of friends that were interested. So I was constantly kind of getting at least being immersed in that community. And then somebody like Joe, had to basically explain it to me. And then I was like, oh, right. Wow. This is so much more powerful, so much more diverse in its impact than just being currency or just being an asset.
Yeah. And I think it's very serendipitous, maybe that's the word, maybe there's another word, fortuitous, that we're catty corner to each other, because I think what's happening in this office,
we're almost at the same height too. You can literally see into our offices from here practically.
And it is an incredible feeling knowing that, like, everybody out in this room right next was down the hall at Unchained, in the middle of the floor at Pleb Lab, like, all working on these, because that's the other thing too, like, Bitcoin is so new still, even 16 years in, there's many things that need to get built, many ideas of what can be built, and it's truly an exploration of ideas in this building. And I think it is a bit poetic that we are catty corner to each other as you guys are embarking on exploring a new realm of higher education.
Well, all I can do is agree. I feel it too. It's kind of comes full circle to the beginning of the conversation about sort of the magic of what's happening in Austin, particularly on this corner at 6th and Congress. And these days, I walk down the sidewalk and I bump into people who are doing these amazing things. And then I wonder about the people I don't even know that are walking past me. I'm like, is this person going to be the next person that cures blindness? Or is this going to be the next person that, figures out some new way to do the Federal Reserve? You don't know. You don't even know who you're walking by.
And like right down the street, we had the Mothership, a bastion of free speech in the world of comedy, is right down the street from us.
It's incredible. I mean, you got the full spectrum of not just innovators, but intellectuals, everything from academics, at UT as well as University of Austin and elsewhere. But you've also got, the podcasters and, so the Joe Rogans, and then you've got the Elon Musk, and you've got, think about the amount of firepower in Austin. I mean, Austin's punching so far above its weight, intellectually at least, that is extraordinary. I mean, it's hard to even kind of put it into, to really quantify it. But you can feel it. You know, you can feel like, well, how are so many of the most important people in the country in terms of changing the direction of the country, pushing things forward? Wow, there's an awful lot of them are in Austin. Why? You know, what is that? They're not in St. Louis, right? They're not in, you know, I mean, I'm sure those are fine cities, but like, why is it Austin?
Silver lining of COVID. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this. I mean, it drove a lot of people here. It drove me here. I think that was like Texas generally putting the flag down, saying we're going to be relatively free to the rest of the country.
I agree. Look, I think it was a transformative moment for the country. I mean, if you look at the internal migration, it's the largest internal migration, as I understand it, in the history of the United States, except for the what they call the Great Migration in the early part of the 20th century with African Americans going out of the South to the North. Because of Jim Crow and so on. So that was a huge period of internal migration. But the largest since then has been this migration during, immediately after COVID. Well, again, if the first question that economists ask is, why is this happening? Okay, well, where are they migrating to, for example? They're migrating to Texas, Florida, Tennessee. What do those three states have in common?
Yeah.
No income tax. That's not the only reason. I'm just saying they don't, right? What was their COVID policy? All relatively free, right? Same thing with Utah, for example. So it doesn't take, you don't have to dig too hard to start seeing, oh, there's something different happening in the places where people are moving to relative to where they're moving from. And you can start to say, oh, common sense, you know, tells us that this probably matters. It probably matters that they have a more favorable tax policy, more favorable regulation, more sane approach to COVID and so on. Sorry about that. So thought I'd turn that off. It's just been this incredible shift because of COVID. I mean, it's tragic in the sense that it kind of is so disruptive, but of course, like any kind of disruption, it can reshuffle the deck in some good ways.
I think a lot of good ways, obviously what's going on here in Austin. I think it's working on a fractal too. We have this reassertion of autonomous state rights, which really shined through during COVID, which I think is incredibly beneficial to the long-term health and quality of life of Americans overall, because it really reignited that interstate competition that the founders basically set out when they founded the country and crafted the Constitution. And I think that's only going to accelerate from here. And we're like what you're doing at UATX is like just like a fractal movement of that, like you're doing at the university level. And that's obviously near and dear to our heart in the Bitcoin community, because Bitcoin is this distributed system, and one of my core beliefs as a Bitcoiner is that this distributed robust system is what we should be building on top of. And you need, whether it's a robust monetary system or robust republic of states with their own individual ways of doing things, or robust distributed university system with a plethora of different models and ideas. This is how systems should organize, is in this distributed fashion.
Exactly. And that's been the magic of the Constitution, for example, is that distribution of power across the branches and so on between the states and the federal government. I mean, the first thing that somebody who cares about a free and open and prosperity, the first thing you should really have, I think, is a general intellectual kind of habit is skepticism, not cynicism, but skepticism, right? Skepticism about centralization of power, wherever it might be, whether that's corporate power, the Federal Reserve, the federal government, whatever. The nature of power is, as it gets more centralized, it gets more corrupt. So when you distribute it out, you maintain that kind of competition of ideas, of businesses, of, you know, doing things better. And so we always want some level of that distribution. Once we lose that distribution, that's the problem, right? When the federal government gets too much power, or the Federal Reserve gets too much power, or the local schools get too much power, things start to go south. And so whatever your politics are, if you genuinely care about, you know, peace and prosperity and justice and moving you have to at least say, ooh, we have to be careful, right? And it's not just whether it's concentrated under Trump. We don't want it concentrated under anyone. I don't want it concentrated under Mother Teresa. You know, it's not so much who's in office. It's like, how much power does that person have once they're in office, right? If you're worried about power, don't just worry about whether, you know, Trump has power versus Obama or vice versa. Worry about whether the office of the president has too much power, or worry about whether Congress has too much power. And so as we see it get redistributed to the states or decentralized through things like Bitcoin, those are positive movements. That creates more competition, more accountability, more transparency. Those are the things that's the sanitation of daylight onto all of these kinds of institutions.
Yeah, completely agree. And I'm extremely optimistic. I'm a child of 9/11, great financial crisis, COVID. Not a child of it, but lived through it. And that is, for most of my life, I've been hyper worried and pessimistic about this centralizing power that has existed throughout most of my life. And maybe I'm naive, maybe a bit gullible, but it does seem like if you squint, you look at what Bitcoin's doing, what UATX is doing, what the Trump administration is promising, you can squint and see light at the end of the tunnel that maybe we are moving back towards sanity and distributed systems that lead to competition and overall quality of life, peace, and prosperity.
Yeah. I think we're starting to see the pendulum swing back towards sanity rather than this kind of nihilism and gaslighting and so on. Right. I think people have just had enough. The trick is not to have it swing too far the other direction where all of a sudden it's like it gets corrupted in a different way.
Yeah.
Friends of freedom, friends of sanity have to maintain their principles in terms of this is why I'm not a big friend of politics, because politics ultimately becomes about tribalism and what tribe I belong to and what tribe I'm loyal to, where what we really need to do is be committed to a certain set of ideas, and decentralization is one of those ideas. So it doesn't really matter like who's in control or what the party is. It's like, it matters what ideas are going to be implemented. I'm optimistic right now. I think we're swinging in the right direction, and I think we have some people who can do some really positive things, but we also have to maintain vigilance and sort of say, do those things. Don't do a bunch of other stupid things.
That is poetic that you said that, because literally the episode we just recorded, that was the whole topic of, as this Trump administration comes in, how do we stay vigilant and hold the new administration accountable
exactly
for the promises.
It can't just be hope. I mean, hope's a great thing. I definitely have some hope coming out of this. I think there's the possibility of some really positive things, but there has to be the vigilance to say, no, you know, we have to do those things. And we also have to not do the dumb things that humans are inclined to do. Right. Retribution. I'm not talking about justice, but actual retribution is a terrible idea.
Yeah.
Terrible. That would spoil the entire thing. So there are things like that we just have to be vigilant about. And if you care about ideas and you care about society and how ideas manifest out rather than your political tribalism, then you have to sort of hold yourself accountable and your own party and your own people, in a sense, accountable. And that's the downside, right? The downside is people get too comfortable and then they start to make the same mistakes that their opponents were making.
Yeah, you have to have the intellectual vigor and competence to hold yourself accountable.
Yeah, so I kind of welcome that. I welcome, for the university, I welcome people holding us accountable to our own commitments, to our own constitution, to our own ideals. I welcome that for the Trump administration. I welcome it for any kind of for the Bitcoiners, you know, that there's always sort of transparency and accountability and so on to keep it true to its principles, because otherwise it runs the risk of getting corrupted over time. Yeah.
I think we're going to win. Optimistic.
Yeah.
The optimism and the potential, I think there's many people opening their eyes with whether it's Bitcoin, AI, what we're seeing with SpaceX, all the booming companies here in Austin, like the potential is palpable. And that's what makes me extremely optimistic. It feels like for the first time in a while, there's this concerted effort to go realize that potential. And I think what you're doing, what we're doing, we're going to look back in a decade and be like, I'm glad we were doing this because it was the right time.
I was telling my wife last night, I was like, you know, it's weird knowing that you're probably living through a moment of history, not just where things are just kind of going along, but like we're seeing this kind of cataclysmic shift, right? Or this transformative kind of shift. And And again, that's not the election I'm talking about. It's really the culture, and it's entrepreneurship, and it's shifting a lot. Of course, it shifted during COVID because of what we talked about earlier, but now it's shifting back in some other directions. And the way it's shifting culturally, I think, is largely positive. I think this is a time where people really can be more hopeful, more optimistic. If they can move past the tribalism of politics and literally just look at what's happening in the world in terms of what's possible, I think there's some good reasons to be optimistic. Like you said, you know, the Bitcoin kind of phenomenon, the university and some of the reforms and innovations there, technology, you know, despite all the problems in the world, there's so much opportunity to do things better. And we have people actually going out there and trying to do those things better. With all of the cataclysm of the last few years, people were losing hope and people were sort of acting like it's the end of the world. And I just don't think that's true. And I think this is very much part of the human cycle. Like every 50 years or so, we kind of go through these moments. And we saw that. We saw that in the late 60s. People forget how volatile that was. I mean, the presidential candidate was assassinated, the head of the leader of the civil rights movement was assassinated. Students were shot on campus at Kent State, all in the space of a few years. I mean, it was unbelievably, dynamic and dangerous, polarized, and yet we made it through, mm-hmm. right? We can make it through the current moment, and I think we've started to see that we are making it through the current moment. And that people are stepping up in different ways, whether that's education, finance, politics, whatever, to try to start doing, to kind of emerge out of this morass into sanity, into hope, into something positive. So I agree with you. For the first time, I'm starting to feel more hopeful about what the kind of country we can have and the kind of community we can have.
Yeah. People keep working, keep building, keep going after. We like to say a lot on this show, we're going to win. I think we're going to win.
Yeah. Again, I'm an optimist.
Yeah. Chad, this has been incredible. Thank you.
Yeah.
For taking some time.
It was a pleasure.
Come across
on a Friday afternoon.
I need to get over there and check it out. I've not been to
Everybody
UATX.
Should come and visit UATX yeah. and see it for yourself.
I got when's the next event you guys are having?
Tonight. 5 in about an hour.
Oh, shit.
Exactly. You gotta drop by.
I got to let
There's
you
a huge get. Event tonight, an open house. So it's mostly for students and parents. I don't think you probably have young kids that are 18-year-olds yet.
No, not yet.
But it's open to everyone to come drop by and just see what we're building, right? And talk to the faculty, talk to the staff, see the campus, kick the tires.
Awesome. Well, I'm sure you have to go prepare for that, so I won't take up any more of your time.
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Peace and love, freaks.